From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, all the mesquite you can eat. Sound appetizing? The Texas native scrub tree has gotten a bad rap, and it's delicious. And how native peoples of Texas used trees to communicate to their descendants and the race to save those trees today. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The mesquite tree. Easy to say, it's not a popular tree for Texas ranchers. It's thorny, it hogs water, stingy with shade, crowds out grassland, and it's almost impossible to kill. But there's another side to mesquite. It could be considered a super tree that has positive attributes that benefits the ecosystem above and below the ground. And maybe mesquite is also a super food that's tasty too. Rodney Bovey is a longtime rangeland scientist with the Agricultural Research Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He's written the book, Mesquite: History, Growth, Biology, Uses, and Management.
Mesquite, it's kind of a worldwide problem, but my book is kind of emphasizing Texas and the Southwest.
What do you mean it's a worldwide problem?
I'm not sure you can say it's a problem everywhere, but some species are a problem, like honey mesquite that we have in Texas and velvet mesquite that they have in Arizona. And they have spread and become big weed problems on rangeland. Most species are probably not problems because, like in Mexico, they use a lot of the mesquite, probably 80% of it, for cooking and firewood. There's a lot used in furniture making and making of, you know, crafts and small items such as flooring and belt buckles and utensils, kitchen utensil or what have you. And the same in South America. Most of it's used in furniture making.
So the most interesting thing about mesquite that I found reading your book is about how the pods are food. It's edible.
It's very edible. You know, it's about 9 to 17% protein, 20 to 30% sucrose, and about that much fiber. But most of the protein occurs in the seed itself. It can be as high as 40% protein. The problem with it is there are some anti-nutrient factors in it, such as tannins and alkaloids that, if high enough, can be poisonous to livestock.
Those are tannins and alkaloids, that's in the leaves, though, mostly, right?
Yes, and probably the reason that animals reject it, you would think you could control it with goats or livestock, but they refuse to eat it.
The native peoples of Texas and across the United States were very reliant and made great use of mesquite.
Mesquite was a very dependable plant, and they could depend on it every year to go back to the same places and collect the seed and the pods. And they made all kinds of things from it, everything from drinks to candy to bread. And they stored the dough for long periods of time between deer skins. So it pretty much supplied their needs. They used it for weapons and all kinds of construction material, cosmetics. Some recent studies showed that there's about five chemicals or six chemicals in the plant that are antidepressant chemicals, antiviral, antibacterial, a lot of things. So the early people knew what they were doing when they consumed it. And a lot of it was used to treat eye conditions. So there's a lot of things in there that we probably really don't even know about.
The mesquite tree itself can grow under very harsh conditions.
Exactly, and it'll survive when a lot of other things won't survive because it has a tremendously deep root system. There's been roots found in Texas as deep as 40 meters in a mine shaft and about 50 meters deep in Arizona in a mine shaft. And it also has a lot of surface roots that grow laterally. So it can also take advantage of a lot of surface water as well as deep water.
So with this interesting root system that it has, people have accused mesquite of being a water hoarder. Does that hold up?
Yes. When it's growing well, it's an extravagant user of water. In lean times, it can shut down metabolically and uses very little, so it can adapt to the conditions it's in. It takes about 800 grams of water to produce 1 gram of mesquite, so you can see it's a rather extravagant user of water. And on the other hand, it can bring water up from deeper depths as well as nutrients for its own use and for the use of associated plants. So sometimes you find the best grasses under mesquite because of the high fertility versus the open areas where there's no mesquite.
So even though it can be a water hoarder, mesquite has been used to fight the spreading of deserts.
Yes. One feature it has is that it'll grow in highly saline soils, soils of real high pH that a lot of plants won't tolerate. One time I was in Puerto Rico and I was on the bay and I saw this beautiful mesquite tree growing about 10 feet from the ocean and I couldn't believe it. And the people on the Texas coast say the same thing.
That's because the ocean water would be so salty that it would be very difficult for another tree to adapt to that.
Exactly. There are some species of mesquite that will tolerate salt water that is saltier than ocean water. It can be used in areas such as on the coast of Hawaii, for example, to prevent soil erosion. In Hawaii, they use the plants for bee plants, in other words, to make honey. So it serves two functions there.
I'm hearing this story from you that mesquite may have a bad rap.
Well, in some ways, but yet ranchers don't like it. They feel that it robs their grasslands of forage that they could use for livestock. But on the other hand, nowadays, you know, we're probably tolerating more mesquite in the landscape because of wildlife use. Many, many insect species and wildlife species depend upon mesquite for a food source and for protection and for shade and what have you. It probably has more benefit than we've realized in the past. The reason it spreads so widely in Texas and the Southwest is that cattle like the beans. They eat the beans. The beans pass through the digestive tract and they're deposited in the manure on the soil surface, and that's how a lot of this mesquite was spread.
Well, these stockmen, they may not be fans of mesquite, but they're partly responsible for it spreading so much.
Yes, and you find the mesquite along the old cattle trail drives to the north. The mesquite, normally if they fall from the tree, they've already been infested with insects, and usually you can't find many viable seed. But if they pass through the digestive tract of an animal, it kills all the diseases and insects on the seed, and they germinate readily. That's the main way they get transported from one location to another.
Back to eating the pods. So have you ever had any of the bread and things made from the mesquite flour?
Yes, a lady over in East Texas, she made some bread from it, and you couldn't really tell it from bread made from wheat.
So it'll rise and all that?
Yes, that was my only experience with bread made from it, but they indicate they can make crackers and bread.
Now, I heard you can make an alcoholic beverage out of it as well.
Apparently, the Indians did, and yeah, let it ferment, and I don't know just how they did it, but it was a drink that they used.
Because it had that sugar content, I guess you could turn it into booze.
Yes.
The mesquite tree also is very, very beneficial to the soil.
Mesquite, that's a way of fixing nitrogen from the atmosphere.
I'm sure a lot of ranchmen are listening to this and wondering, quit telling me how great this thing is and tell me how I can kill it.
Well, yeah, I spent a lot of my career trying to find out how to kill it, and we went through a lot of chemicals, and I guess the latest thing is combinations of remedy and reclaim.
And these are off-the-shelf herbicides.
Herbicides, and that would be applied at about a quarter pound of each material, a one-to-one mixture.
What about mixing it with diesel? I hear that a lot.
Per acre. Diesel, Yeah, it can be used in aerial application, or diesel can be used as a basal spray and then be fortified with Remedy. Just follow the label on the, or the instructions on the herbicide label, because that's the legal way to do it.
Should every rancher just sort of be focused on trying to wipe out every mesquite tree he's got on his land, or should he keep a few going?
Well, if he wants to control the mesquite, I think he needs to go with a very heavy stands and try to thin it out and just treat some of the better, more productive land that he has and kind of forget the rest. Like I say, we're in this holistic approach to brush control anymore. We tolerate more brush and mesquite in the landscape, and I think it's beneficial for both for wildlife and, you know, holding the soil in place and this sort of thing. So I think we can tolerate quite a bit of mesquite.
So you're calling a truce for the war on mesquite.
Well, I guess you could say that.
Rodney Bovee is a longtime rangeland scientist with the Agricultural Research Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He's written the book, Mesquite: History, Growth, Biology, Uses, and Management. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. Across Texas, there are some magnificent trees that have some odd features. They might have branches or trunks that suddenly jut out at 90-degree angles, or bow strangely along the ground. Some of these trees may have been tied down and twisted long ago by the native peoples of Texas. Long before there was GPS, there were the marker trees of the First Nations. Now there is a race on to find, identify, confirm, and preserve these historic trees before they are lost. Steve Hauser is a co-author of the book, Comanche Marker Trees of Texas.
The Comanche Marker Trees of Texas are trees that were shaped many years ago, over 145 years ago, to designate a specific natural feature, such as a trail or low water crossing on a river, things of that nature that would have been important at that period of time.
When we have them today, they're still out there?
Some of these trees do still exist today, and I know it's kind of a surprise. I was surprised 21 years ago when we recognized our first tree, being an arborist for many years at the time. I was a little skeptical because I've seen a lot of trees that were bent by nature, and there are a large number of trees that are bent due to ice storms, wind storms, one tree falling on another tree, a smaller tree, things of that nature can create many of the same shapes, which made it very confusing until we recognized our first tree. And I spent time with the Comanches and the elders and historic preservation officer. Then I started to understand that some of these trees are real and they were actually bent by them for a specific purpose.
And this isn't just in Texas. This is a phenomenon that is throughout North America.
Well, we understand that there's many other tribes that use these same types of techniques, although somewhat different. For instance, the Ute tribe or the Ute Indians in the Colorado Mountains, they are known to have medicinal trees and what they call prayer trees. Medicinal trees are ones where they stripped some of the bark off and used it for medicinal purposes. Their prayer trees basically took their prayers to the great creator. That's what they were. They were kind of a conduit as a way to reach their great creator and pass along their prayers. So there's other instances. Dennis Downs, a longtime friend, works on a different type of marker tree up around the Great Lakes area. There's also the Mountain Stewards that were established, I think, 2007, to start to recognize and understand trees. They do more across the nation. They collect information on these trees. So we think that there's some tribes that did it for sure. There's other tribes that may not have done it, or they don't recall that they did it from many years ago.
But it appears that there is an awakening that is happening about these trees, their importance, and the need to identify them and document them.
Right. They are living witnesses to a very unique society and their ways of life that still exist to this day. And that is kind of underscores the importance of recognizing these trees before they're gone. One of the trees in the book, for instance, that we produce, Comanche Marker Trees of Texas, was lost during a drought about 4 years ago, which is unfortunate, but it underscores the need to recognize them because natural forces can take them out, as well as development and other activities. So we really want to recognize them before they're gone, because once they're gone, that's it. And, you know, the elders that have understanding of these trees start to pass away over time. One of the Comanche medicine men, Thomas Blackstar, started to write his death song last year. He's the last remaining medicine man that there'll ever be in the Comanche Nation. So that's another example of where we're starting to lose the people that have a knowledge of these trees as well.
So how many of these documented marker trees do we have in Texas?
There are six in the book. There are three others that they have officially recognized since the book was written. But that's all we have to date. Now, in the same sentence, I mentioned that nature can create these same shapes of bent trees. I've had over probably 500 trees now that have been submitted to us as potential marker trees, but very few of them end up to be trees that I can prove or without some reasonable doubt that the Comanches were there at a period in time, and that they did, in fact, tie down or bend these trees on purpose. I would also mention, and I know this can be even more confusing, even if nature created a bent tree, it doesn't mean that the Comanches didn't use it as a marker tree.
The phrase, extraordinary claims demands extraordinary evidence. Is this an extraordinary claim to say, oh, that is an Indian marker tree, and so you're going to have to go and really prove it beyond the shadow of a doubt that it actually is in order for us to identify that tree as that?
Well, there's you have to understand, in the early 1900s, we went to the Comanche Nation and quite a few others, took everything that they had that was written and burned it, from their maps to everything they had written. So it's very difficult to say beyond a shadow of a doubt. But a bent tree, first of all, has to be old enough. I do a lot of ring dating on them to try to quantify that they're indeed old enough, which rules out a lot of them. The next step is to do what we call reading the landscape. In other words, I've got to go back 150 years ago and find out if there was a purpose for this tree. Did it serve a purpose? And were the Comanches known to be in that area at that period of time? That is very difficult to prove. We do that in many different ways. You know, we start with a topo map to find out what was the topography now, what would it have likely been at the time. We compare the tree and its direction to early trail maps, for instance, is another example. We go back and research the history, preferably from the beginning of the land grant, and follow it all the way along to find out if there's any evidence in there as well. So there's a lot that we have to do to quantify whether or not these trees are real. We also have a team of trained volunteers that go out and collect information on the site from each one of these potential trees. So it's quite a process, and it's very difficult to be able to prove that the tree had a purpose and to connect it to the past history of the Comanche Nation.
In the book, you mentioned San Pedro Springs, the possibility of a marker tree being there, San Pedro Springs being near downtown San Antonio, and we know was a significant area for the native peoples. What's the story with that tree?
Still being researched. I mean, I have probably 100 trees right now that we're still researching and trying to find out more about them. So we need to collect some more information on a number of trees in the San Antonio area. Now, it wasn't probably the traditional Comancheria is what they call it, or the area that the Comanches claimed, but they also traveled to these areas in order to trade. you know, southern parts, it could be the Lipan Apaches that they were trading with. In East Texas, it can be the Caddos. They made treks out to East Texas to trade with them. Well, they weren't forest dwellers. They were known to be the lords of the plains, and they stayed out in the plains for the most part, but they still traveled to some of these areas, which is good and bad. It makes it more difficult to be able to track exactly where they went and for what purposes. So, you know, the San Antonio tree is another one that's still under investigation, and we, you know, until we do extensive amount of work on it, yeah, we just don't know.
Were these supposed to be multi-generational markers?
Sure, without a doubt. They can go back for quite a period of time.
So, but they were doing this action in order so that their descendants would be able to follow these markers.
Correct.
This was a means of communication through generations.
Right, and that's one of the reasons that I mentioned the Ute tribe, because the Comanches originally stemmed from the Ute tribe. So it's likely, and we're spending more time with the Utes to talk about the connection between the trees, because we think the Comanche probably took that idea when they left the Utes and used it as they traveled as a good means to not only direct them, but direct them to important resources, whatever it might be. The 1720s was the first phase of the Comanche expansion going north and south out of Colorado. And it kind of goes on from there. But, you know, there's a tree, for instance, in New Braunfels. It's very large, very old. It's bent. And the concerns that we're having with that is the Comanches weren't down there at the period of time that the tree was bent, which, you know, leaves us kind of mystified. In other words, South Texas especially, some trees can be too old to be within the realm of when the Comanches were there.
But they might be some sort of marker tree, not just one for the Comanche.
That's a fact, and that's where we think that there were other tribes that probably did this. We also think that if nature created an odd or bent-shaped tree, it could have still been a marker. In other words, you know, if you're an early American settler and you're giving directions, you'd say, go to the big cottonwood and turn right, or you'd say, go to that bent tree on the creek and turn this direction or whatever. So they could have been used as directional aids, even though they were created by another tribe or by nature.
On the cover of the book, we see a tree that seems to be crossed over, sort of forming an X between the two trunks. Talk about that tree.
That one is a unique tree in that it grows along the ground for a good 15 feet and then sprouts upwards. It doesn't really cross itself, although it kind of does if you look at the cover. It appears to cross itself. But that tree, as well as the California crossing tree, are directly related to a low water crossing at the time. Ultimately, it was called the California crossing because of the gold rush, and everybody traveling to California, that was where they went to cross the river. Because many years ago, you had a lot of priorities. It was food, water, shelter, but also direction. You know, you had to know the right place to cross the river, or you weren't going to be able to cross it. So
you need to know where to ford the river.
Right, where to go across the river. And once you came across it from the west or from the east to the west, you'd cross and hit this tree. This tree was directly related to the Birds Fort Trail. And as a matter of fact, the parking lot, or the parking area, the park for the city of Irving, is called Birds Fort Trail because that's exactly where the trail was known to be.
What is your favorite marker tree of Texas?
My favorite marker tree of Texas?
I mean, which one comes to mind when you say, that one's a beauty?
Well, the first tree we recognized was a long arching bow pecan, which was a really cool tree. There's quite a story on that in the book. What started the decline of that tree was the power line installation and the development of the neighborhood took the top out of the tree, and from there it started to decline. It's probably one of the more showy of the trees that we've looked at.
And where is that?
It's Gateway Park in East Dallas is where the tree once existed. We lost it in a storm about a year after it was recognized. Actually, it was in a Memorial Day storm, kind of ironically, that the top was lost out of it. And it was a long arching trunk that touched the ground, bowed out, touched the ground, and then it was broken off in that point. And I was, being an arborist, I thought, well, a pecan tree traditionally would try to grow back even if the top was lost. So I watched it for a number of months, and it wasn't trying to grow back. We found out later the whole inside of the trunk of the tree was hollow. So we weren't able to revive it, unfortunately. So that was one of my favorite trees.
Do you think that if we had the awareness about the importance of the original nation's marker trees across the United States, we would have been able to save that tree, prevent it from being hacked up?
Recognition doesn't in itself force the property owner to preserve it or to do anything, and that's a pretty critical point to make, because we have had property owners say, well, I don't want to recognize it, then I could never cut it down or I couldn't do anything with my property. No, that's not the case. We want to recognize them before they're gone, and even if they're lost, they're still kept as part of history within our records and within our website and books and things of that nature. So we want to try to preserve them for future generations to understand and to enjoy. And I think it's that connection to nature that the Comanches and all American Indians had, which is going to be important in the future. I mean, we develop our cities more and more. We get further and further away from nature, and that has its own difficulties. And I can get on quite a subject there, but that's what changed my life quite a bit. When we recognized our first tree, I was walking to it with James Yellowfish, and I said something about nature, and he stopped, took off his glasses, grabbed me by the shoulders, looked me in the eyes, and he says, "We are one with nature. We live within nature." And that's when I started to realize that we as a society have gotten far away from nature. That's why people that go out and walk the trails and get back into nature tend to be a little bit more healthy, mentally and somewhat physically as well.
You are the Steve Hauser of tree climbing competitiveness fame, are you not?
Well, that's one of the many things that I've done with a good part of my life. I've always been a tree climber, and it's one of the things I've really enjoyed. And it's helped me to understand the Comanches' connection to nature, because what I work on is nature itself. And there is a feeling that you get as a tree climber. This is hard to describe to a novice, but when you're climbing a tree, you get a sense for how that tree is doing. This tree is very healthy. It's doing quite well. This tree is doing poorly. I need to try to help this tree. It needs fertilization. It needs these other things, because you can kind of sense that it's not healthy. You know, when you have to do a removal of a tree that's dead, that's not a lot of fun. I don't like to do removals because you don't get that connection with nature.
Can you talk about your experience working with the Comanche in this project?
Well, I think to begin with, I didn't know them that well. We recognized our first tree. And in the beginning, you have to understand that the way we treated all these American Indians, they're very skeptical of working with anybody with a white face. And I hate to say that, but and I don't blame them a bit. So in the beginning, it took them a while to understand, I'm just a volunteer arborist, that I love trees, but over time they started to accept me as just a volunteer, just working with them to help them reconnect with a significant part of their history.
Steve Hauser is a co-author of the book, Comanche Marker Trees of Texas. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.